The future is a hefty responsibility and not one that we take lightly. But then taking things lightly has never been what Hefty is about. That's why we've created the Hefty Renew program that turns hard to recycle plastics into valuable resources like park benches and building materials. To participate, simply fill up an orange Hefty Renew bag with accepted items, tie it up, and drop it in with your regular recycling. That's it. It's that easy. It's time to rethink recycling with Renew. Particular valued resources may vary by geography. More info available at heftyrenew.com.
When you drive a vehicle so reliable it's backed by a 10-year, 100,000-mile limited warranty, you stop thinking about what you can't do and start doing what you never thought possible. Visit your local Kia dealer today to see what you're capable of in a vehicle that inspires confidence around every corner. Kia. Movement that inspires.
Call 800-333-4KIA for details. Always drive safely. Limited inventory available. Warranties include 10-year, 100,000-mile powertrain and 5-year, 60,000-mile basic. Warranties are limited. See retailer for details.
I want to tell you about a podcast Preconceived listeners will really be into. Uncertain Things, a show where uncertainty is embraced, partisanship rejected, and ideas challenged. Uncertain Things hosts are two jaded journalists who've interviewed and argued with some stellar guests. They've grilled writer Matt Taibbi on the mediocrity of media, pressed historian Neil Ferguson about the end of the world, and asked The Atlantic's Caitlin Flanagan why sex has gotten so bad, statistically speaking. If you want to leave your preconceptions behind, and if you're listening to this pod, I think you do, then check out Uncertain Things wherever you get your podcast. That's Uncertain Things.
You are listening to Preconceived, where we examine the preconceptions that shape how we view the world and the paradigms by which we live our lives.
Hey everybody, I'm Zale Mednick, and welcome to another episode of Preconceived. The Trojan War is one of the most famously described and arguably mythologized accounts from ancient Greek civilization. As recounted in Homer's epic poem, The Iliad, it was the passion-fueled war waged by the Greek states against Troy. Homer's account is filled with the type of drama that has the perfect makings for a compelling Hollywood film. And indeed, the 2004 film Troy, starring Brad Pitt, exemplifies how this story has persisted for thousands of years in the public imagination. But what exactly do we know about the Trojan War? How much of it is rooted in historical fact? And how much of the epic saga is simply myth? And at the end of the day, myth or historical fact, why, if at all, is the Trojan War worth caring about? I'm joined today by renowned historian, Professor Barry Strauss. Barry is a classicist and military and naval historian and consultant. He's professor of history and classics, Bryce and Edith M. Bowman Professor in Humanistic Studies at Cornell University. Professor Strauss is the author of 9 books on ancient history, including Battle of Salamis, The Naval Encounter That Saved Greece and Western Civilization, Masters of Command, Alexander, Hannibal, Caesar, and the Genius of Leadership, 10 Caesars, Roman Emperors, from Augustine to Constantine, and the book most relevant to today's episode, The Trojan War, A New History. Professor Strauss is a well-known television personality with appearances on the History Channel, the Discovery Channel, CNN, PBS, and Netflix. He is the host of the popular podcast, Antiquitas, Leaders and Legends of the Ancient World. His latest book is The War That Made the Roman Empire, Antony, Cleopatra, and Octavian at Actium. His regular blog can be found at barrystrauss.com, and listeners can sign up for email updates from the same website. All right, Professor Strauss, welcome to the podcast. Thanks for joining me.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here. Thanks for having me.
So we are talking today about the Trojan War. So for those who aren't history buffs, I still think you'll enjoy it because it's a really cool story. And I love doing the occasional history episode on the podcast I listen to are mostly history episodes. So for the Trojan War, for those who aren't familiar with it, Barry, it might be helpful to start with a bit of a brief synopsis of the Iliad and kind of the popularized version in pop culture of the story of the Trojan War.
Sure. So the Iliad and the story of the Trojan War are not precisely the same. The Trojan War is a story from Greek mythology, and it's meant to have lasted 10 years. The Iliad is the story of about 2 months in the 9th year of this 10-year war. The war was caused when Helen, the queen of Sparta, ran off with a guy known as Paris and also Alexander. He was a prince of Troy. She left her husband and daughter in Sparta and went off to Troy with him. And the Greek kings and chieftains had all sworn to protect this marriage because Helen was the most beautiful and desirable woman in Greece. And so they form this great expedition. They sail across the Aegean Sea and they attempt to take Troy, which they're unable to do. And the war lasts 10 years until they finally take the city. The Iliad, as I said, is about 2 months in the ninth year, and it focuses not on Helen or Paris or the armies in general, but rather on Achilles, who is the greatest warrior in Greece. And it's really the story of Achilles, and particularly the story of what happens to him in that ninth summer of the war, ninth year of the war. So according to the version that we all know from mythology, the war lasts for 10 years. The Greeks completely fail to take the city of Troy by storm. They defeat the Trojans in battle, although they themselves suffer some defeats. But ultimately, they're only able to take Troy through a trick, the famous Trojan horse, in which the Greeks pretend to break camp, and they do break camp, and they pretend to sail back home. But in fact, they only sail to a nearby island. And at night, the Trojans are celebrating. The Greeks have left behind a large wooden horse. The horse is the symbol of Troy. And the Trojans, against the warnings of Princess Cassandra, who saw the truth, they admit the horse to the city. And that night, while they are celebrating, Greek warriors who are hiding inside the horse break out. They open the gates. The Greek expedition returns on its boats from the nearby island, and they sack the city of Troy. They kill all of the men, and they enslave the women and children and destroy Troy. That's the myth.
And it's quite a dramatic story.
I think so, yeah.
So the Iliad that Homer's account, and he granted he wrote this approximately 500 years after the supposed events at play, but that only really covers a very tiny part of the Trojan War.
That's
who was
right.
The main historian that commented on the rest of the Trojan War back in the day when this happened?
Well, I wouldn't use the term historian. I would say poets. We know about the Trojan War through a series of epic poems, none of which exist anymore. The only ones that exist are Homer's Iliad and the Odyssey, which talks about the aftermath of the war. But there were other poems such as the taking of Troy and the Ethiopia, it's called. There are a series of other epic poems that no longer exist, but which are referred to by other later ancient authors. Probably the best known one is Virgil, who was a Roman who lived at the end of the first century BC. And he wrote the greatest epic poem in Latin, the Aeneid, which includes in it the story of the destruction of Troy, the day and the night in which Troy was destroyed when the Trojan horse was left behind and the Trojans take the bait. We also get a lot of the stories as retold by the Athenian dramatists, Aeschylus, Sophocles, Euripides. They use the Trojan cycle, the stories of the Trojan War, to infuse a lot of their drama. And many other Greek poets as well also retold the story of the Trojan War. This was the story of stories for the Greeks. The Greeks didn't have a Bible, but if they had had a Bible, its two testaments would have been the Iliad and the Odyssey of Homer. So the stories he tells and the stories that other poets of the epic cycle tell, those are the basis for our information about the Trojan War.
Now, the Trojan War happened thousands of years ago, correct?
About 1200 BC.
1200 BC, so a very long time ago.
Yeah,
I know that there was some archaeological discoveries that obviously has happened since over the last couple of centuries, and we're obviously going to get into your book and some of the research that you've done. But up until that point, was the Trojan War, was it considered mostly a myth to people, or was it considered historical fact? How was it viewed by people over the last 2,500 years up until the more recent present?
Well, people in the ancient world had no doubt that the Trojan War really happened. So hard-nosed, realist historians like Thucydides, for example, were certain that the Trojan War really happened. They didn't accept the clearly mythological, fantastic parts of Homer, like the gods on the battlefield and that sort of thing. And they debated whether the Trojan horse really existed or not, or whether there was a simpler trick or ruse that allowed the Greeks to take Troy. but they had no doubt that the war really existed. In early modern times, in more skeptical times in Europe, say, of the 18th and 19th centuries, the general attitude was, these are myths. We really can't put any credence in them. And we really can't be sure of much in ancient Greek history before the middle of the first millennium BC. So sometimes the starting date of ancient Greek history was considered to be the year 776 BC, because that was traditionally when the first Olympic Games were held. And so it was thought, well, the Greeks must have had some kind of system for keeping dates and records. So if they say something happened in 776, we can think that Greek history began by that time, perhaps a bit earlier. So that's the attitude that people had up to the late 19th century.
And then what happens at the late 19th century that maybe changes people's perspective?
So archaeology explodes in the late 19th century. There are already British and American diplomatic officials who are stationed in the Western Ottoman Empire, as it then was, who are poking around and talk to the locals and think they have found the site of ancient Troy. It's at a place called Hisarlık, which means something like a castle, a fortified place in Turkish. And it was there in the 1870s that Heinrich Schliemann, a German who'd emigrated to the United States, started excavating. He got permission from the Ottoman authorities to excavate there. And in a series of seasons of excavation, he announced to the world that he had discovered the site of ancient Troy. He then went on, he crossed the Aegean Sea to Greece, which was by now independent, and he excavated the site of Mycenae. Unlike Troy, Mycenae had never disappeared. People knew that it existed, but they just didn't know how much was there. And he excavated there, and he found remarkable discoveries at Troy, but even more spectacular discoveries at Mycenae, gold death masks that seemed to come from kings, or at least noble chieftains, aristocratic chieftains from ancient Greece, as well as the architecture of the fortress at Mycenae. And he found the architecture of the citadel Troy as well. So these were earth-shattering developments. Not everybody was convinced, and a lot of academics had their doubts about it, but Schliemann was seen by none other than Kaiser Wilhelm, the Kaiser, who believed that these discoveries added greatly to the prestige of the young German Empire, and also was particularly interested in an alliance with the Ottoman Empire, between the German Empire and the Ottoman Empire. And Schliemann's discoveries were very helpful to his diplomacy. Eventually, in the early 20th century, an academic German archaeologist re-excavated the site and put it on a scientific footing. And the site has been re-excavated by a series of German and American archaeologists over the 20th and now the 21st century, and Turkish archaeologists involved as well, I should say. So there have been a number of excavations, a number of different scholars have worked at Troy, and we know a great deal about it by now.
I'm always fascinated when I hear about archaeological discoveries, and it reflects my own naivete about archaeology, understandably, because I'm not an archaeologist. Uh-huh. But what kinds of things are they finding in these excavations that are suggestive, not only that this civilization existed and that Troy existed, but that there was this war that resembles the war that had been talked about for so many centuries?
Good question. So what they found at Troy was, first of all, the fortress walls of a citadel, and they are very tall and impressive walls. In more recent years, they also found the traces. The citadel was the upper city of Troy, and it's quite small. I don't remember, about half an acre in size. But they also found the evidence of a wall that did the lower city, and that was about 75 acres in size. So it was a relatively large area for the Bronze Age, for this period of history, 1200 BC, excuse me. And it was very well fortified, which suggests that people were concerned about defense. The city was destroyed in a great fire around 1200. And we've also found evidence of arrowheads, spearheads, a skeleton that was buried inside the city wall, which you would never do unless you couldn't get outside, which would suggest a war. So the evidence that there was a great city that it's located where Homer says it was located, that it was fortified and it was destroyed in a fire. The evidence for all of that is, I think, untouchable. It's absolutely secure. Although, as always in scholarship, there are a few people who deny it and say it's not true. But most people accept it. Most scholars accept it. The evidence that it was destroyed in a war, that's a little bit weaker. Personally, I would like to have found more weaponry at Troy than we find. If we go to some other ancient sites where battles took place in a later period, such as the destruction of Jerusalem in the year 70, there archaeologists have found a lot more weapons and a lot more signs of war than they have at Troy. However, there's a big difference in the world of 70 AD and the world of 1200 BC. Jerusalem was a lot more built up in the year 70 than Troy was in 1200. On top of that, Troy was picked over by visitors, tourists of all sorts, people and VIP tourists like the Persian Emperor Xerxes, Julius Caesar, Augustus. Those were some of the people who went to Troy. And there was a flourishing industry selling visitors ye olde artifacts of antiquity. So also, of course, Troy was rebuilt, as was Jerusalem, to be sure. And so there is some explanation, I think, for why there are so few weapons of war that are found there. It should also be pointed out that the lower city of Troy was built on bedrock. So whatever was there originally, almost everything that was originally has washed away. We found very few artifacts from the lower city. Almost all of them come from the upper city, which is a much smaller area.
Mm-hmm. So you wrote The Trojan War, A New History.
Yep.
To me, it's just a super interesting story. But to you, there's a lot of interesting stories in history. What made you want to write this? Was it to get to the bottom of what happened? Was there a specific significance about the Trojan War beyond the fascinating story that you felt was important to be documented?
Well, I think what's important is the new excavations and the new discoveries that came out in the 1990s and in the aughts of this millennium. The new excavations there discovered the lower city, which really changed the picture of what we had at Troy. Because before then, we thought there was a lower city, but we weren't sure. They also discovered the harbor, which we hadn't found before. Another thing that happened is that so a lot of what we know about this period comes not from Greek sources, but from Hittite sources. The Hittites were one of the great lost empires of history. They were centered in what is now Turkey, and their capital was ironically right near the modern capital of Turkey, right near Ankara. They were a very powerful empire whose main interest was to the south. So what is now Syria, Israel, Egypt, Jordan, Palestine, those areas. But they were involved in what is now Western Turkey as well. When their civilization was destroyed shortly after the destruction of Troy, they left behind a treasure trove of documents. They were written on clay, and in the fires that destroyed their civilization, they were baked, the clay was baked. Something similar happened in Greece. The difference from what we have in Greece is what we have in Greece is basically tax records and recruitment records for the army and navy. From the Hittites, we have all sorts of literary documents, historical documents, letters, how-to books about this and that. And these documents have been pored over by scholars. It was first pointed out in the 1920s that there's some striking similarities between the names in Homer and the names in these documents. But most scholars are very skeptical of this sort of thing. But they've been restudied in the last 20 years or so. And I think it's been shown convincingly that there are things in Homer that really are in these documents, which is fascinating when you think about it. For example, in Homer, the city of Troy has two names, Troy, and Ilion. And in the Hittite documents, there's a place that has two names. In Hittite, it would be Taroissa and Willusa. And I should point out that in early Greek, the name that's now Ilion was Willian. So the Greeks said Troia and Willian, the Hittites said Taroissa and Willusa. There are a number of fascinating coincidences like this. There's other evidence that has come out. I mean, just tons of evidence that makes things that seemed like myth to be reality. Another place, for example, where we have archaeological evidence is the city of Ugarit in Syria. It was an important port city, and it was destroyed around the time that Troy was destroyed, or a little bit afterwards. There are letters between Ugarit and various other places in the eastern Mediterranean. One seems to refer to Cyprus, and it refers to Cyprus as Elysia. The clay in this letter, which is also preserved by a fire when it was baked, has been studied, and it is shown that it comes from Cyprus, and it actually comes from a place in Cyprus whose modern name is Elysia. So very similar to this ancient name. There are just so many things like that that tell us that the world that Homer describes couldn't have been simply a myth. Yes, the story's been reworked and changed and mythologized, but it was based on a certain bedrock of facts.
Yeah, it's really incredible to think of just a story that was, or a poem that was written so long ago, to be able to centuries, millennia later, look at it from your perspective and from an archaeological and historical perspective and say, wow, a lot of this stuff is real. It's kind of tough to really grapple, to wrap your head around, huh?
Yeah, I know. But if you go to France, for instance, and the archaeological museum outside of Paris, they have these beautiful ivory carved figurines and stone carved figurines that are 30,000 years old.
Wow.
Just a reminder of how long humanity has been around.
How important, if at all, and I mean, I assume it was, because you said if the Greeks had a Bible, that the Iliad would have been their Bible. Mm-hmm. From a Greek perspective, how important was the Trojan War? Because ancient Greek history spans a very long time,
right?
I believe. What was different or important about this war that it would have been their Bible?
Okay, so really good question, and I'll answer in a couple of ways. For one thing, these people and ancient peoples in general were not really all that interested in history as we're interested in history. They're interested in stories about the past that had a moral, and they wanted the stories to be based on a fact, but they didn't insist on the absolute truth. Even some of the models for history, like Thucydides and Herodotus, in their history, they try to ascertain the facts, but they also have many, many speeches. And the speeches are only roughly connected to what was actually said. Thucydides says that his speeches try to stay as close to as possible to what was really said, but they tell us what they should have said. And I think that we need to keep that in mind when thinking about ancient prose history, and even more in thinking about ancient poetry. The ancient audiences wanted this to be close to the fact, but they didn't insist that it be any more factual than a Hollywood movie or than a Netflix series, based on the facts, but not really the facts. So that's kind of how they're looking at the stories of the Trojan War. But to get to your question, so why is the Trojan War so important? So when we think of ancient Greece, we think of the city-states, we think of Athens, we think of Sparta, we think of the Parthenon, and they're all tremendously important. But before they developed, there was an earlier period of Greek history, mostly in the second millennium BC, so between 2000 and 1000, roughly. And the Greeks of that period lived in kingdoms. They had kings, like the kings in the Iliad, like Agamemnon or Menelaus or Odysseus or Achilles. They were not city-states, and they were pretty rough and tough, even savage peoples. And one of the main things they did was they went on military expeditions and raids. They fanned out, they conquered the islands of the Aegean Sea. They fought as mercenaries in Egypt. We have absolute evidence of that. And they engaged in raids and wars on Western Anatolia, what is nowadays Western Turkey. And we have indisputable historical evidence of that as well. And so the Greeks in later period wanted to know, where did we come from? You know, where did our civilization come from? Who are our ancestors? And stories like the epic cycle told them about their ancestors in what was remembered as their greatest single achievement, the Trojan War. Was the Trojan War really as great a war as Homer says it was? Undoubtedly, it was not. Undoubtedly, it was a much smaller war. Epics exaggerate. We know that. But it was the way for the Greeks to think about their past. And it preserved a lot about their past. The names of characters in the Iliad and the Odyssey are not the names of characters in later Greece. In later Greece, Socrates, Pericles, Alcibiades, they're not named Achilles or Odysseus or Laertes or Agamemnon. But as I mentioned earlier, we have these tax documents from early Greece. And the tax documents show us that the names in Homer are actually names that were used at the time in the second millennium BC. Likewise, many of the places that Homer describes no longer existed in the Golden Age of Greece, but archaeology shows they really did exist in the time of the Trojan War. But there's another aspect to this whole thing, and that is one of the purposes of the Iliad for the Greeks was to explain what the gods wanted. What was morality all about? What were the rules of behavior? What would a just society look like? What are we expected to do in this world? And for the Greeks, the Iliad and the Odyssey answered those questions, at least in a traditional way. That's why they were so important for ancient education.
In terms of morality, it sounds cliche to ask, and with a lot of historical questions, I'm sure you get asked this, but what are some of the moral lessons that people back then and now take out of this story?
Sure. Help your friends, hurt your enemies. That would be one of the first lessons. It may sound like something out of The Godfather, but it is exactly the traditional definition of justice in ancient Greece. Help your friends, hurt your enemies. Honor was tremendously important. People were very sensitive about their honor and were constantly concerned about not being dissed. He dissed me is one of the traditional explanations for why people would go to war in this world. Related to that, I would say that everything is personal would be another moral of this society. So in our society, we think that if you're going to go to war, well, you shouldn't go to war, first of all. But if you do go to war, it has to be for some important abstract underlying reason, like justice or democracy, or perhaps the economy may depend upon it. But in the ancient world, the one and only reason to go to war, well, you could go to war for loot. That would be okay. But mostly people went to war for personal reasons, to defend their honor or to show that they were men of honor who could go out and fight and defeat the enemy. So that would be another moral. Another one is that the gods have set up the world so that nobody enjoys unmixed happiness. Everybody has, as the Iliad says, for everybody gets their fate from two jars of Zeus, one that contains good things and one that contains bad things. And life is full of good and bad things.
Yeah, I mean, all relevant lessons. One that I find particularly interesting that you just mentioned is the reasons we go to war, because some people, when you look at the Iliad and the story of the Trojan War, I think it's natural, especially present day, to look at it and say, well, that's kind of ridiculous. Not to be too passe about it, but it's ridiculous that they would go to war over one man stealing another man's wife. And whether it wasn't even necessarily stealing, many of the depictions have it that Helen of Troy did want to leave and join Paris.
Right.
And people say they started this 9-10 year war with obviously leaving families for this long, deaths of so many people over one or two people's decisions. And you're saying that actually is viewed as maybe an honorable thing at that time, whereas now I don't think people would look at it that way.
Well, that's a really interesting question. We have something called the Amarna Archive. This is a series of diplomatic documents discovered in Egypt from around this period. And it's been described as the first record of international relations that we have in history. There are letters between Egyptian kings, Hittite kings, and a lot of princes who came from what's now Israel, Palestine, Jordan, ancient Canaan, Lebanon as well. And it's clear again and again in these letters that what motivates people is personal honor. I go to war because this guy insulted my father. That's the sort of reason why people go to war. We actually do have one or two examples of people going to war over a dynastic dispute having to do with a woman. So is it credible that the Greeks invaded what's now Turkey and attacked Troy for 10 years because of Helen? No, that's not credible. But might they have gone to war against a place that was wealthy that they wanted to raid anyhow? Because the wife of a Greek king had run off with a prince from that town and Homer makes a point of saying, when Helen and Paris left Sparta, they took the crown jewels with them. So they didn't just go, but they took the national treasure with them. And again in Homer, he says, you know, honor is an issue, but so's loot, so is booty. And they measure honor in concrete terms, in how much loot you have, how many cattle you took, how much gold and silver you got, how many beautiful women you were able to run off with. Those are the ways in which they measure their honor.
And I'm actually going to correct myself, or not correct myself, but as you're saying that, I made the comment before that today people probably wouldn't view personal reasons as a good reason to go for war. But that doesn't necessarily mean that that doesn't still influence in modern times the reasons why people do go to war, even if they're not broadcast as well. And this is by no means a political statement at all, but people criticized George Bush saying that he went to war in Iraq because he wanted to finish what his father started. And I'm not getting into that. I'm not saying that is why he went to war.
Sure.
It just goes to show that it isn't necessarily as ancient of a concept, potentially, as maybe we like to think of it. Maybe we today like to think that wars are more based in reasons related to the greater good than they are.
Sure. That's a good example. But to give another one, at the time of Vietnam, one of the things that American politicians said as to why the U.S. had to get involved in Vietnam was they said American credibility is at stake. Now, there's really not that much difference between credibility and honor. They wouldn't have put it in terms of honor, although they certainly would have talked in terms of honor at the time of the Civil War in the mid-19th century. In the mid-20th century, they had to talk about credibility instead and the lessons of Munich. But those are abstract principles, not all, in some ways, with some similarity to the idea of we have to go to war because the sanctity of marriage has been abrogated.
Yeah, I mean, I think in some ways we like to look at the past as so different, but maybe it's just presented a little bit differently. And with perspective, some of our wars today will not look so much different when compared to the motivations of wars of the ancient past.
Indeed.
The future is a hefty responsibility and not one that we take lightly, but then taking things lightly has never been what Hefty is about. That's why we've created the Hefty Renew program that turns hard to recycle plastics into valuable resources like park benches and building materials. To participate, simply fill up an orange Hefty Renew bag with accepted items, tie it up, and drop it in with your regular recycling. That's it. It's that easy. It's time to rethink recycling with Renew. Particular valued resources may vary by geography. More info available at heftyrenew.com.
Lucky Land Casino, asking people, what's the weirdest place you've gotten lucky?
Lucky? In line at the deli, I guess?
Aha, in my dentist's office. More than once, actually.
Do I have to say?
Yes, you do.
In the car, before my kids' PTA meeting.
Really?
Yes.
Excuse me, what's the weirdest place you've gotten lucky?
I never win and tell.
Well, there you have it. You can get lucky anywhere, playing at LuckyLandSlots.com. Play for free right now. Are you feeling lucky? No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
I find the characters really fascinating in this story. Mm-hmm. Do we have any evidence about Achilles, for example, whether he particularly existed and whether his feud with Agamemnon was real and whether he the manner in which he died was accurate?
No, we don't have any historical evidence about that. We know that that names are one of the easiest things to carry down from generation to generation. So while, you know, some of the details of the Trojan War in Homer are very questionable, less questionable is that there are people who had these names. So I find it plausible, though I can't prove it, that there really was someone named Achilles, there really was someone named Agamemnon, there really was a Helen, there really was an Odysseus. We can't prove any of it, but it's not implausible, not at all. Yeah. And like I say, some of the names in Homer we do find in the surviving historical in tax records in this period, let's call them.
And then in a similar vein, is there any evidence at all that this famous Trojan horse had any existence?
No, absolutely not. And most scholars are very, very skeptical about it. I'm not so skeptical about it, because what we do have evidence of is people taking cities by tricks. We have evidence from the Roman period of Hannibal taking a city by a trick and of the Romans retaking the city by a trick. And we have evidence from the Bronze Age, from Mesopotamia, of, you know, an army laying siege to a city and being unable to get the city to surrender. So they pretend to leave. They march off, and the residents of the city say, "Hey, we've won. The war's over. Let's relax. Let's open the gates." And the enemy army comes back the next day or night and takes the city. So that's not all that different from what the Greeks did at Troy, really. So I think that's pretty good evidence for the sort of thing described in the story of the Trojan horse, for that sort of thing to happen. In a way, the Trojan horse is not all that important. The main thing is that the Greeks pretended to leave and the Trojans believed them and let their guard down. That's the main thing.
The notion of trickery, and that certainly was a possibility based on at least other historical trickeries.
Absolutely. Yes. Yeah. Yeah. It's very plausible.
So, Professor Stoss, I just want to end by asking you, this is an episode where the preconceptions are quite clear on the theme of preconceived,
right,
because there are so many preconceptions about what is myth,
right,
and what is history.
Right. Right.
But for people listening to this who just find this interesting, but is there anything you'd leave with them about why they should care about this story of Troy?
Well, if you care about road rage, you should care about Achilles. The first work of Western literature begins with the word rage, and it's the story of a young man having to come to terms with his own emotions and his inability to control his emotions. More generally, it's really a question about the extent to which emotions like honor and pride and desire for glory affect the things we do in life, in particular affect whether countries decide to go to war or to make peace. And also, it's just an amazing detective story of how, you know, we start out by thinking we're much smarter than those people in the past. All their stuff was myth and we know it. And then when we actually dig, we discover, wait a minute, it's not just myth. Those people in the past were pretty smart too. And it's a way of putting ourselves in historical perspective. I think it's all there. Plus, you get to read these fantastic works of literature, the Iliad and the Odyssey, the Aeneid, Greek drama, all that.
Cool. Well, I obviously, you don't need to convince me, even though I asked you to convince the audience, because I find it super, super interesting. Thank you so much for joining me on the podcast. I really, really appreciate it. And
you're welcome.
I want you to tell me a little bit about your latest book, The War That Made the Roman Empire, Antony, Cleopatra, and Octavian at Actium, because that sounds super interesting as well.
Thank you. I published that book earlier this year, and that's the story of one of the great pivotal battles in history, the Battle of Actium. If the Battle of Actium had gone the other way, we might now be speaking a language that was based in Greek rather than in Latin. And the center of gravity of ancient civilization might have been in Alexandria, Egypt, rather than in Rome. The consequences for the whole future of civilization are incalculable. How much was at stake in this battle? It's a fascinating story in and of itself. It's also a story that involves, if not trickery, then at least strategic cunning and the willingness to take risks. And it's got one of the most fascinating characters in all history involved in it, Cleopatra. There are few people who incite our interest and excite our fascination as much as Cleopatra does. And so I really enjoyed this story. And this is also a detective story, also one involving lots of archaeology in addition to literary sources. So it's just a great yarn.
Well, it sounds fascinating. And I think I'm going to read it myself because I love that kind of stuff.
Thank you.
And where can people learn more about you? And I know you have a regular blog that you update
every couple
weeks.
So I have a website, which is conveniently called barrystrauss.com.
Very convenient.
And there you can find my latest book and all my earlier books, as well as my podcasts. I do have a podcast called Antiquitas, Leaders and Legends of the Ancient World, and my blog. And these days I'm blogging once every 2 weeks. So I just put up a new blog earlier this week, and I think I can guarantee that it's a lot of fun and covers all sorts of ground on things ancient and modern.
Well, Professor Barry Strauss, you're clearly a busy guy, and I am so grateful you took the time to join me. I learned a lot, and I'm sure our guests did too. Thank you so, so much for joining me, and I'll be putting all those links in the episode notes.
Thank you. It was a real pleasure. Thank you for having me, Zale.
And thank you, everybody, for listening to another episode of Preconceived. Have a great day.
Future is a hefty responsibility and not one that we take lightly, but then taking things lightly has never been what Hefty is about. That's why we've created the Hefty Renew program that turns hard to recycle plastics into valuable resources like park benches and building materials. To participate, simply fill up an orange Hefty Renew bag with accepted items, tie it up, and drop it in with your regular recycling. That's it. It's that easy. It's time to rethink recycling with Renew. Particular valued resources may vary by geography. More info available at heftyrenew.com.
Okay, round two. Name something that's not boring.
A laundry? Ooh, a book club. Computer solitaire, huh?
Ah, oh, sorry. We were looking for Chumba Casino. That's right. Chumbacasino.com has over 100 casino-style games. Join today and play for free for your chance to redeem some serious prizes. Chumbacasino.com. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.